Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The painting of the Sistine Chapel ranks as one of the greatest of human achievements. Its creator, Michelangelo, one of the world's great artists. Our guest this week, Ross King, has written on both, and he'll share with us what he's learned about the creation of this magnificent work of art. And after that, Omer Bartov, professor of European history at Brown University, looks at the recent history of reactions to violence, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, and more in the scholarly community. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on August 15, 1914, the Panama Canal is officially opened to traffic. Crossing the Isthmus of Panama, connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, the American-built canal had a complicated beginning. The isthmus originally belonged to Colombia, and Colombia awarded the rights to build a waterway across it to a French company in 1881. Racked by disease and poor financial planning, the French project failed, and in 1902, the U.S. Congress authorized purchase of the failed company and allocated funds for the canal's construction. Under terms of a proposed treaty, the U.S. was to pay for the use of the territory, but the Colombian Senate rejected the offer, fearing loss of sovereignty. President Theodore Roosevelt then threw his support behind the Panamanian independence movement, which was successful. On November 6, 1903, the United States recognized the Republic of Panama and gained exclusive and permanent possession of the canal zone in return for a payment of $10 million and an annuity of $250,000. Building the canal was a massive undertaking, but it was completed in 7 years at a cost of $400 million. In 1997, President Jimmy Carter agreed to return the canal to Panama, and the transfer was completed on December 31, 1999.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the American Civil War, Jay Winnick argues in a recent History Channel documentary, could have ended even more tragically than it did. By the end of the war, 600,000 men on both sides had been killed and a million more wounded. But when General Robert E. Lee sat down with General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox, there were still about 175,000 Confederate troops in the field. The day before the meeting, Lee called a council of war, Winnick explained, and one of his aides said, "We can move to the hills like partridges and rabbits and continue to fight." Confederate President Jefferson Davis had already called for guerrilla fighting days earlier. It could have led to the Vietnamization or the Middle Easternization of America, Winnick concluded. The consequences would have been profound. Fortunately, Lee disagreed with Davis's strategy and sought peace. And a document recently discovered at the Harry S. Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, supports the position taken by President Truman that what motivated him to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima was evidence that 500,000 casualties would result from any U.S. invasion of Japan. In recent years, Truman's critics have called this into question, arguing that the figure was made up after the fact to justify the action. The document, described by D.M. Giangreco in an article in the recent issue of Pacific Historical Review, shows that Truman received a warning that the invasion would cost as many as 500,000 to 1 million American lives in a May 1945 report prepared at Truman's request by former President Herbert Hoover. This is Talking History. Why was the Sistine Chapel built? Who built it? Why was Michelangelo chosen to paint the ceiling? And how did he choose the subject of his famous painting? These are just a few of the questions Talking History's Eileen Dugan asks of her guest this week, Ross King.
Nearly 500 years after its completion, the ceiling of Rome's Sistine Chapel remains one of the greatest achievements of humankind. We cannot but help feel overwhelmed by the torrent of images so perfectly arranged, by the drama of the story being told, by its flawless depiction of human forms and emotions. Gazing at the ceiling, we can't help but wonder, how did Michelangelo do it? What must he have gone through to complete this? With us today to explore the history of this most majestic work of art is Mr. Ross King, author of Brunelleschi's Dome and the recently published Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. Welcome, Mr. King.
Hello, thank you.
Why did you decide to write a book on the Sistine Chapel?
Well, I've been interested in fresco for quite a long time, fresco as a technique, and also the stories around many of the frescoes of the Renaissance. And I thought that where better to, or who better to approach, really, than Michelangelo, who is, I think, now regarded as its greatest practitioner.
And let's face it, there have been many books written about the Sistine Chapel, many art history books. Why did you think that the story needed to be told again?
Well, I think most books on the Sistine Chapel and maybe on Michelangelo in general are sort of photo-heavy and text-light. And I wanted to sort of do an opposite version. I wanted to tell the story of Michelangelo's 4 years in the Sistine Chapel as a story, because I think that hadn't really been done, certainly not recently. And I wanted to take those 4 years and arrange them into narrative form, while also giving a kind of panorama of the age and all of the characters involved. And in particular, I suppose, I wanted to explore the relationship between Michelangelo and Raphael, because I was fascinated that these two men painted two of the most famous frescoes in Western art at the same time, literally only a few steps away from each other, and of course with the result that these two masterpieces can be seen with a 3-minute walk in between them. And so I think that was really what I wanted to focus on by coming to Michelangelo.
One of the really nice things about your book is how you place the Sistine Chapel and Michelangelo's work within the historical context, and talking about the condition of Rome, of Italy, and the papacy around 1500. How would you describe the world of Michelangelo at this time?
Well, the world he was inhabiting in Rome wasn't an especially pleasant one. Nowadays, when we think of Rome, I think we think of the Baroque Rome, or the Rome of Bernini, and later in the 16th and 17th centuries. But around about 1500, when Michelangelo first came to Rome and then began working in the chapel in 1508, Rome was a very unappealing place. It was dangerous, dirty, decrepit, and didn't really have any new buildings in it in the way that a city like Florence did. Rome is known as the Caput Mundi, or the capital of the world, but it was really anything but, and it wasn't really a worthy seat for the church. And the church itself, as I describe in the book, was really in a bad way throughout the 14th and 15th centuries, with the result that by the time Michelangelo came to work for Pope Julius, the popes had really had their powers depleted. They were secular leaders as well as spiritual leaders at this point, but a lot of their spiritual power, a lot of their secular powers had been taken away. And so what happens then in Michelangelo's lifetime is that Pope Julius II comes along and decides that he's going to change all of this. He's going to make Rome into a worthy seat for the church and also restore the papacy to what he believes should be its true power.
How powerful did Julius II become? He's known as the warrior pope.
That's right. Popes generally fought wars. I mean, it was a rare pope who didn't engage in his forces in one battle or another in order to see off a competitor in the Papal States. But usually they stayed at home in the Vatican very safely during these engagements. Julius was very different. He couldn't be accused of shirking his duty or staying behind the lines, and he actually led his troops into battle on a number of occasions, as I describe in the book. He was a very belligerent character and thought that he was the going to be the best general to lead the papal troops, most of whom are Swiss mercenaries, into battle against the French or the Duke of Ferrara, the people of Bologna or Perugia, whoever happened to antagonize him that particular year. And so through these campaigns of conquest, he tried to expand his power base in Rome and in the countryside around. But as I also describe, he ultimately encountered great difficulties doing this, and not only endangered his life, but those of everyone in Rome at certain points as well.
Why was Pope Julius interested in having the Sistine Chapel in particular decorated?
Well, the Sistine Chapel is named for his uncle. Sistine refers to Sixtus IV, who was the uncle of Julius II. They were both from the Della Rovere family, and Sixtus IV commissioned the chapel in 1474. It was going to be the apostolic chapel for the Vatican Palace. So it was a very important building within the Vatican and really for the church as a whole. It was completed in 1480, some 23 years before Julius, the nephew, took the throne. And by that time, by 1503, the chapel had begun to lean, causing cracks in the ceiling and damage to the fresco that had been painted there in the 1480s. And so I think Julius, who regarded the Sistine Chapel understandably as a sort of monument or a temple to his uncle, wanted to make certain that it was an appropriate monument. And so that involved replacing this worn-out fresco with a new one, a fresh new one, in 1504, 1505, when the damage manifested itself. And of course, at that point, Julius thought he knew exactly the man for the job to paint this new fresco. And that, of course, is Michelangelo.
Why was Michelangelo reluctant, though, to undertake this job?
Well, he considered himself first and foremost, and in fact almost exclusively, a sculptor, and understandably so. He was known most of all by this point for two works of art. The Pietà, which he'd finished around 1500, and which was now adorning the tomb of a French cardinal in Old St. Peter's. And secondly, the David, which had been finished in the summer of 1504 and which was placed in its spot in front of the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence in September of 1504. And Michelangelo had worked at this point, he's roughly 30 years old, and has worked almost exclusively in sculpture for the past 15 or 20 years. And really didn't have very much fresco experience. He'd trained in the medium for maybe a year or two, but hadn't followed the usual painter's apprenticeship. And therefore, it was a very daunting commission to be given 12,000 square feet of vault when you weren't a frescoist. And so I think, understandably, he had little appetite for it initially.
What makes fresco painting so difficult?
Well, fresco means fresh, and that implies how you worked on fresh or, in other words, wet plaster. And so if you painted a fresco, it wasn't simply a matter of taking your piece of charcoal or chalk and sketching freehand on a wall or a vault and then painting the dry stone or the dry plaster. And what you had to do was paint on a wet patch of plaster, maybe 10 square feet or 20 square feet if you felt particularly ambitious that day. And in order to do that, you had to go through all sorts of preparatory steps that I describe in the book. And fresco is known as the most difficult and demanding of all of the painting techniques, and indeed of all the artistic techniques, with the exception perhaps of casting in bronze. And so it was not something that could be taken lightly. It was said that many men could paint in tempera, but only the very greatest could ever succeed at fresco, and it was in fresco that all of the great reputations were made, from Giotto to Masaccio to Domenico Ghirlandaio. And so fresco is where it was really the most, it was the technique in which you showed your true talent, and if you hadn't, like Michelangelo, a lot of experience in it, then possibly you were going to run into difficulties.
You mentioned earlier that at the same time Michelangelo was doing the Sistine Chapel, Raphael was just a few steps away doing his frescoes. How well did they get along?
They didn't get along at all. Michelangelo was extremely suspicious of Raphael. Michelangelo was quite a paranoid individual, and he was very suspicious of, he was suspicious of most people, but he was especially suspicious of other talented artists, Leonardo da Vinci for one. Michelangelo didn't get on with him either. And so when Raphael appeared in Rome in 1508 to work in the Vatican, literally next door to the Sistine Chapel, alarm bells went off for Michelangelo, and he realized that he was going to be in competition with Raphael, who was 8 years younger than him. Raphael was in his mid-20s at this point, and was really the coming man in Italian art. He was sort of the pretender to the throne of Leonardo da Vinci, who was the greatest painter in Italy, if not in Europe. And so Michelangelo, I think, understandably, was extremely worried that he was tackling a commission at the same time as Raphael, who actually did have more experience in painting. Michelangelo, I think, kept his distance from Raphael, but also very crucially tried not to let Raphael see what he was doing in the Sistine Chapel. He wanted to keep all of his drawings and the fresco itself a secret until he unveiled it, so that Raphael couldn't see what he was doing and then possibly plagiarize it.
There are many myths associated with Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, and you discuss them. What are some of the myths that you essentially debunk in your book?
Well, I think one of the things that leaps to mind when you think of Michelangelo is him lying on his back painting the vault of the Sistine Chapel, and that is a nice story, but unfortunately, it's not true. This legend, and it is only a legend, goes back far beyond Irving Stone and Charlton Heston in The Agony and the Ecstasy, which I think is the moment that it really becomes embedded in our consciousness. That story goes back to Michelangelo's own lifetime, where a short biography is written of him by a man named Paolo Jovio, in which Jovio describes how Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel, and he used the word resupinus. He wrote it in Latin, used the word resupinus, which was usually translated as, mistranslated as on his back, whereas it should have been translated as bent backwards, because as anyone who's painted a living room or bedroom ceiling knows, you have to bend backwards and extend your arm upwards in order to paint. And we know that Michelangelo painted standing up because, you know, among other reasons, because he left drawings of himself, which I reproduce in the book, showing himself clearly standing upright on the scaffold painting. And it wouldn't have made sense for himself to have given himself only 3 feet of crawl space, in effect, to work in. And so I think he probably did have a clearance of 6 or 7 feet from the base, from the top of the scaffold to the vault. The other one, of course, the other myth is that he worked alone in the Sistine Chapel. That was a myth that was perpetuated by Michelangelo himself, who claimed that he had no help whatsoever for most of the time that he was working. And unfortunately, that's a nice story, but it's a myth as well. No one ever painted a fresco on his own, especially one that was 12,000 square feet. Fresco was always the result of teamwork, and the Sistine Chapel was no exception. And it's clearly documented through letters and contracts and so forth that Michelangelo had assistants who worked with him, side by side with him, on the scaffold, helping him to paint. And so while he painted many of the signature pieces himself, such as the figure of the creation of Adam, a lot of the repetitive architectural detail and the backgrounds were painted by these lesser-known men that he brought from Florence specifically to help him work in the chapel.
What was the public's response to the ceiling, and what was Julius's response?
Well, first of all, the public had a very positive response to it. When the chapel was opened and the fresco was finally unveiled after almost exactly 4 years of work in October of 1512, and it was said that all of the people of Rome flocked into the chapel to try to see the fresco, and then very quickly word spread, and it became a sort of site of artistic pilgrimage, and any artist who had any pretension to being great couldn't be worth his name unless he came to Rome from wherever he was in Europe and viewed the Sistine Chapel. And so very quickly it entered the pantheon of Western art. Julius's response was somewhat more muted. He was a great fan of Michelangelo's work, but he, after it was unveiled, he sort of made the usual noises about, you know, it's a fantastic work of art and so forth. But he did think that Michelangelo needed to get, sort of rebuild his scaffold and climb back up and brighten it up a bit with a few extra touches of gold and ultramarine. Michelangelo refused and said that this wouldn't be a it wouldn't be true to life, since the people he was painting on the vault of the chapel, the Hebrew prophets, for example, were poor people, and they didn't have gold in their clothing or ultramarine cloaks, and so he protested, and Julius backed down, one of the rare occasions when Julius backed down, and the ceiling was left as it was.
We only have a moment remaining, but why do you think we still feel awestruck in the presence of the Sistine ceiling? What does it say to us?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about Michelangelo's work in the Sistine Chapel is that it lives up to expectations. And truthfully, not a lot of paintings or perhaps even natural wonders really do. Oscar Wilde, for example, said that seeing Niagara Falls was the second biggest disappointment of the honeymoon. And I think everyone's familiar with that sort of something that you feel you know already through photographs or film, and then you see it. And you're sort of disappointed by it. I think the Sistine Chapel in no way disappoints. Once inside the chapel, you truly appreciate not only Michelangelo's artistry, but also the incredible physical and technical feat of painting 12,000 square feet of vault that rises more than 60 feet above the ground. I think, just in conclusion, I would say that maybe what we feel is summed up by the German poet Goethe, who wrote that without seeing the vault of the Sistine Chapel, it was impossible to understand what man was capable of achieving. And so I think that even after various technological triumphs that ensued over the centuries, such as skyscrapers, airplanes, space travel, and so forth, the Sistine Chapel still does represent a kind of high watermark of human endeavor.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. King.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Mr. Ross King, author of Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling.
Continuing on the subject of this week's interview, Michelangelo's painting of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, for our site of the week, we've decided to tell you more about the famous chapel and the Vatican museums among which it's included. Here to tell you about both is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
The Sistine Chapel, one of the greatest art masterpieces in the world, was built for Pope Sixtus IV by Giovannino the Dolci. Its walls were decorated by artists like Sandro Botticelli, Luca Signorelli, and others. The ceiling, as you just heard, by Michelangelo. The chapel, however, is only one of the many museums in the Vatican. The founding of the Vatican museums can be traced back to 1503, when Pope Julius II began purchasing art and organizing it into exhibit collections. Future popes added to the collections and created new museums. Among the most popular today are the Christian Museum, comprising artifacts from the catacombs that could not be preserved in situ, the Etruscan Museum, the Egyptian Museum, the Gallery of Tapestries, the Gallery of Maps, and the Vatican Picture Gallery. Our advice? If you're planning on visiting the Vatican Museums, don't count on seeing them all in one day.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Contrary to popular opinion, American scholars and academics have not always opposed the use of violence. In some cases, they've supported it. As our guest commentator, Omer Bartov, suggests, theirs is a mixed record, which leads him to consider what's the best position they could take in such matters. Bartov is the John P. Berkland Distinguished Professor of European History at Brown University.
Since the 19th century, numerous cases of ethnic cleansing, genocide, and terrorism were legitimized, supported, and at times perpetrated by scholars and academics. The 1904 German genocide of the Herero in southwest Africa was justified by fears of racial pollution. The racial categorization of Rwanda, imposed by Belgian colonialists, culminated in the genocide of 1994. The 1915 genocide of the Armenians was intended to facilitate the creation of a modern Turkish nation-state cleansed of ethnic and religious aliens. Nazi plans for an Aryan-dominated living space dictated the genocide of the Jews and the ethnic cleansing of Poles and Russians. German political scientists, historians, geographers, biologists, and physicians sanctioned and executed these policies. Criminal communist regimes enjoyed the support of Western academics and intellectuals for much of their existence. Conversely, pacifism after World War I led to the disastrous appeasement of the 1930s, and the anti-war reaction to the Vietnam era has complicated the response to the attack of September 11th. The attack came from a weak and loose international organization, but the terrorists have the will and possibly the means for acts of mass destruction. They combine the rhetoric of atonement for imperialism with theological and apocalyptical arguments. Violence, perceived as inherently evil because it is usually applied by the strong against the weak, has now come from the most impoverished regions of the world. Reacting effectively calls for a revolution in thinking about the use of force and about economic policy abroad. The lesson of the last century is not that we must always oppose violence, but that we should be able to identify whether and when force should be used against those who seek our destruction, and then explain why the use of force is legitimate. We must distinguish between the use of violence to put an end to crimes against humanity and violence intended to destroy the notion of shared humanity. We must also insist that the world that emerges from this confrontation is one in which everybody would prefer and be able to be part of humanity rather than remain locked out of it. For those left out today are tomorrow's suicide bombers.
You've been listening to Omer Bartov, Distinguished Professor of European History at Brown University and the author of In God's Name, Genocide and Religion in the 20th Century, and The Crimes of War, Guilt and Denial in the 20th Century. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. For more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau. Have a nice week.